more than two decades, whatever plans Uzbekistan may have had to liberalize the cotton sector have not produced the intended results for ordinary farming people. People of villages and towns throughout Uzbekistan, where cotton remains king, from Andijan to Khwarezm, do not have too many choices if they wish for an existence that is beyond subsistence. What they can do is migrate to the country's cities, to neighboring countries, or to the so-called far abroad. Alternatively, the able-bodied from formerly cotton collectives can gravitate to other types of agricultural work, namely the growing of grains and/or fruits and vegetables. However, even these alternatives would require the securing of land, water, seed, and all manner of other inputs that are not readily available in areas where the land has been fixed for cotton growing alone. I am arguing that for more than 20 years of political independence, the Uzbek government has not looked so much to the people of the cotton-growing areas of the country for their human ingenuity, their ability to innovate, or for their own notions about the kinds of work and careers they may wish to pursue, but rather for their labor power, in the sense of continuing to be a pliant population that succumbs readily to life that continues to be commanded, much as I wrote about in detail in my book here. To be sure, not every person who works for and supports the current regime feels the same way about cotton. We can be sure that there are softliners to go along with all of the hardliners who continue to make policies in agriculture. But the softer views do not seem to have any upper hand in liberalizing approaches. While no sensible scholar could have imagined that there would have been something akin to a rapid dissolution of collective farms with concomitant privatization and abandonment of cotton growing, one has to question how well the policies in this sector have served the citizenry, given a continuation of the worst of Soviet-style policies without the benefits of the Soviet welfare state. The results have been a large-scale exodus of the rural population, at least on a temporary basis. And I had some slides about that, but, well, they're not working, so we'll press on. For those who remain, and scholars only now are beginning to interview and work with the families of migrants, remittances certainly help to make the relative poverty of village life more bearable. But this is unlikely to become a viable long-term solution for the healthful development of rural society. For people who became accustomed to the cycles of cotton because of personal connections over the course of 3 to 4 generations, cotton does not necessarily have a reputation as scourge. It is not hated, and people who work it and work with it don't necessarily want to abandon it. As I point out in my book, you can also eat cotton, as you very well know, in the form of cottonseed oil, which is much beloved by the rural population. So it is a complete and total product. Rather, they want to make more money for all of the work they do in helping produce national wealth. So far, however, such a transformation of opportunity has not materialized. The continuity between governance and cotton from the late Soviet period till the present appears obvious. The government sees cotton lands as a somewhat decentralized series of fiefdoms. The peasants or farmers, quote-unquote, who work these lands and those contracted to do the picking do not determine how much should be grown, what sorts of cotton should or can be most profitably grown, and above all, they not only have little idea about international commodity prices for cotton, but they have little to no determining effect on how much money they should or could make for their work. Furthermore, with the decline in mechanization during the mid-1990s, many cotton-growing regions became de facto latifundia. Part of my original thesis, based on research in the 1990s, was that we were undergoing a process of re-peasantization, as I called it, in the Uzbek countryside. I was told by many publishers that was not going to make for a bestseller, so that did not become part of the title of my book. With exceptions, notably in Jizak province during the previous decade, and some of you may recall the seizure of private plots undertaken by the governor of that region, Uzbek peasants have not been very rebellious. And while there are reasonable political scientific explanations for this, there is also the simpler one of not wanting to take risks when it appears that there is virtually no hope of gaining advantage, and every reason to believe that nothing ventured means nothing lost, like one's freedom or life. There cannot be any doubt, however, that the hardline decision makers don't have serious reasons for keeping the screws tightened on the local cotton farming population. For one thing, the rural population keeps growing in a way that until recently seems to have vindicated Malthus into the 21st century. Now, my second slide actually shows that the projections are probably in another 10 or 15 years, the Uzbek population is going to have either zero growth or even negative growth. So there's a huge population drop-off, and of course we could begin to discuss reasons for that. But that certainly was not the case during the 1980s and into the 1990s. At any rate, increasing population has meant further encroachment onto lands that could be cultivated. And for another, there is the constant dilemma of effective water use and management, which is a problem that has international dimensions for the Uzbek leadership. Once again, we cannot imagine that solving the problems of liberalizing and enriching the cotton farming areas are easy. However, the authorities have to start somewhere. During the past few years, we've witnessed an increasing effort on the part of activist organizations and Western governments to pressure Uzbekistan to stop impounding people, press ganging people, call it what you will, into cotton labor, especially during harvest times, when the state forces children, students, and adult professionals, such as teachers, into service. The increased enforced labor took on urgency with the exodus of agrarian people to cotton fields abroad as well as to jobs elsewhere. There are indications that the verbal protests and boycotts of Uzbek cotton are causing leaders in Uzbekistan to rethink the way they organize labor. Simply, when such a profitable realm of the country's agriculture faces real decline, proponents of business as usual begin to understand that they themselves are exposed and vulnerable. What Tashkent's critics need not lose sight of is the fact that Uzbekistan is not one large dichotomy of crooks in power and noble peasants in fields. There are corrupt practices and corrupt modes of working at the most local levels of the society. I always like to point out to the old example that existed, of course, from the Soviet period of when the peasants bring in their gunny sacks full of cotton. They also have rocks and dirt in it, and it gets weighed first, and then nobody really cares about the actual weight. It's already been recorded. You learn this kind of behavior, obviously. As was true of communism, so it is in the post-communist dictatorship. People will work conscientiously and speak honestly where it behooved them to do so. The thing that continues to be virtually non-existent in the hinterlands are the opportunities to work hard and live well without entrenched connections to people in power, let alone to understand how the law is almost never solid and never fixed. Whenever a person who has become moderately successful falls afoul of some local power broker, the law, especially in the form of tax police officers, is applied so capriciously that the person who had been the moderate success is undone very fast. Part of my research efforts in the 1990s centered on historical dimensions of peasant farming. The most basic historical connection between the emerging capitalism of the Tsarist Empire and the manic socialism of Soviet communism was that Central Asian peoples needed to be commanded and controlled in order for the territories to produce more and more cotton. In recent political science parlance, I think we might refer to this as Uzbekistan's path dependency, the way in which the past influenced the trajectory which gets us to now. Although we needn't view what became the current eventuality as determined, that is, it didn't have to happen the way it did, clearly leaders had choices too. That Uzbeks have a healthy respect for elders and people with positions of authority cannot be in doubt. It always amazed me that wherever I traveled through the countryside, and especially on what remained of the collective farms, people would bow on roads and in front of their homes whenever the rais or farm leader passed by. When I pointed out to people that they had only sometime earlier told me what an awful person the rais was, they would assent, but add that they always showed deference or respect, hurmat, as people referred to it. This sort of behavioral institution, if you will, is more than likely not a product of czarism or communism, even if the person's office is, but that of the longue durée. It is a long-standing characteristic of what makes Uzbeks Uzbek. All this is not to suggest that Uzbeks don't have limits with regard to their respect for elders and people in authority, for the very same history of the past 160-plus years features its share of rebellions and uprisings against authorities foreign and local when conditions of life or measures for change prove too onerous for ordinary people. Where I see permanence to the siege of rural life occurs at this juncture. The understanding of what distinguishes people in authority from people who do ordinary tasks in everyday life in these villages. Basically, they don't matter. They certainly didn't matter 100-plus years ago, even though much of the past tends to be romanticized as a time when landowners looked after and cared for the peasants. Yeah. And during the Soviet decades, I think we have to acknowledge that peasant and villager opinion mattered very little. However, during particular decades, what peasants and villagers became mattered very much to the state's idea of the transformation of backwardness. And despite the harshness of the regime's regime, many benefits accrued to these people, even as their environments were being destroyed and their health compromised through what was done to the land and water on behalf of cotton. I also believe this is why, as I documented frequently in my book, there is such a strong positive remembrance, a collective remembrance, if I may, among middle-aged people for the Soviet way of life, which meant everything from summer camps, free summer camps, to cheap and durable electronics, to dancing lessons with Beatles music, and Friday night cinema. And I'm being a little bit facetious, but those are a few of the many, many things they could talk about, a quality of cultural life that existed, especially in the 60s and 70s. And when you spent weeks on end picking cotton and living in barracks, the collective farm supplied the brigades at least with one hot meal. You and I can pretend there was no such thing as what local people like to refer to as a period that was serop, or navalim in Russian. Up to here, we had everything we needed. And that, of course, I would date from roughly 1960 to 1987, 88, something like that. But I think the aging peasants are otherwise convinced. For some odd reason or reasons, watching their sons and daughters pack up and leave to pick cotton in Kazakhstan or to work construction in Irkutsk doesn't really seem to measure up to their expectations of what youth should be, to say little of the notion of a socialist social mobility. In 1991, when Uzbekistan became a country for the first time in a modern national sense, there was trepidation that accompanied the excitement, especially because millions of Uzbeks reasoned they would finally be free of the cultural chauvinism and disrespect that had been the Russian-Soviet system. Obviously not everybody, but a significant proportion of the population. And because the late 1980s and early 1990s featured so much criticism and questioning of the Soviet legacy and its policies, there was genuine hope that a new country of Uzbeks by Uzbeks was going to be responsible to Uzbeks. The great slogan of those early years was that Uzbekistan was a state with a great future. Uzbekistan kelajagi buyuk davlat. I always wondered about this term davlat, which, you know, roughly translates as a state. They could have chosen the word mamlakat. They could have chosen the word respublik, but they chose davlat. Maybe it's just a semantic distinction I'm making, and I'm not really aware of all the linguistic complexity, but it's curious to me. The emphasis is on the state. I suppose it is fair to say that depending on where one ended up within the great state 20 years later, the future has turned out to be pretty great. Of course, just as people learned to ignore all manner of superfluous and idiotic slogans and signboards during the Soviet era, it wasn't hard for them to start doing the same in the new independence era. And I should also say that millions of adults ignored the new slogans about Uzbekistan being a free and democratic country, literally because the Uzbek state thought nothing of using the new Latin orthography haphazardly as it attempted to assert its independence and promote a new alphabet better suited to its linguistic phonemes. Unfortunately, many people couldn't make heads or tails of it, just as you wouldn't be able to make heads or tails of Cyrillic if that's what the Washington Post appeared in tomorrow. I once had a great experience with a bus driver who said, we were driving along, and he said, "Can you read that sign?" And I said, "Yeah, sure, I can read that sign." And I told him what town it was. He goes, "I can't read it." I said, "Oh." He said, "It's a good thing I know the route." I said, "Yes, it is a very good thing, so I'll eventually get home." I don't mean to suggest that Uzbeks are not proud of their country, despite and at times even in consideration of the dictatorship. There clearly has been development in the country, including infrastructure, public works, etc., There are thousands of opportunities for the young and gifted and connected to study in the West, and there are all sorts of international connections and relations that make of Uzbekistan a real partner in development and international alliances that were simply unthinkable just over two decades ago. This, combined with Uzbekistan's nationalism and its heavy inward focus on its own sense of history, its understanding of a unique Central Asian identity, certainly infused people with a kind of pride vis-a-vis the external world that many may have felt was gradually disappearing under the Soviet system. Sooner or later, however, Uzbekistan and its substantial rural population will understand that development in a 21st century context will be hard to foster with the stranglehold that the state exercises over the cotton laboring population. Since the mid-1990s, the authorities have lost a degree of control over those who have opted out of the plantation system. And I don't use the plantation system in a willy-nilly way. I use it because that's what people refer to it as, plantatio. And they understood all, obviously, of the connections between North American plantations in the 19th century and earlier, and their own. Okay. So, who have experienced the dead end of protests and petitions, instead opting to vote with their feet. And despite White Gold's strong profitability of more than $1 billion per year, the leadership turned not to increased mechanization or the shifting of unskilled labor forces from other sectors of the economy to cotton work, but significantly to children to help pick the 80% and more of cotton now picked by hand. The past 15 years or so have witnessed Uzbekistan's own variation of a kind of agricultural involution, which was written about by an anthropologist by the name of Clifford Geertz pertaining to Java, although it referred to Java during the colonial period under Dutch rule. Only here, the exacting state is neither European nor colonialist. Naturally, it's in some ways cost-efficient not to invest in the best available technology and then basically to pay the workers next to nothing. In this case, one has to hope that continued international pressure from national governments as well as activist labor organizations and watchdog groups will embolden more and more softliners to begin acting to alleviate this agrarian state of siege. Curiously, Uzbekistan has invested rather heavily in mechanization and expertise when it comes to the grain-producing sector of the economy, but the end result there is that grain is not of the highest quality. Grain has to be mixed with its cousin from Kazakhstan in the end. In concluding today, I do want to emphasize that I didn't set out simply to bash the dictatorship and its policies once again. I want to end, actually, by introducing a project that I am hoping to carry out with a colleague and that we hope may foster improvements in the cotton sector. It's our pie-in-the-sky idea. Our strategy is not exactly grand, and the only chance of success it will have requires openness and cooperation from Uzbekistan's leaders. And this is why the map is up there. Well, anyway, what we hope to do in the next year to 18 months is undertake a pilot study that will be comparative between Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, especially southern Kazakhstan, to be precise. And that's why, and I know I have my little thingy here. I'll try not to blind anybody. So right in this area, Chimkent, which is, you can see, spelled Chimkent in the Kazakh. So the climatic conditions, of course, are very similar there to parts of Uzbekistan, notably like Jizzakh. So I'm going to just talk a little bit about this and then have a closing statement, and we'll turn it over to Behzad. We would like to interview cotton farmers in particular regions of Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan in order to perhaps highlight the notion that farmers in Kazakhstan and even the seasonal migrants from Uzbekistan there are doing a lot better than holds true for Uzbekistan, given more or less the same climatic conditions and the same Soviet legacy. Our research will focus on the following indicators, which we plan to subject to modification during the more serious planning and contract phase: land ownership, relationships among farmers, workers, and representatives or agents of the state, including the state's interests and the degree to which they are protected, how profitability differs in both countries with regard to cotton, how productivity is planned, organized, and executed, what kinds of direct or indirect relationships exist among farmers and the state in terms of futures companies, banks, inventory suppliers, etc., the differing cotton trading relations pertaining to the use of gins, export rights, etc., commitments to mechanization, the for and against tractors, combines, etc., and the incentives for using manual labor. differing labor relations, including contracts for employing worker migrants, and then lastly, the state and the status of cross-border transactions that involve harvested cotton, fertilizers, machinery, smuggling, etc. Our idea about gathering data would include the following informants and organizations: farmers' associations, agricultural workers and labor migrants, local activists, experts, local officials, investors, and representatives of suppliers, gins, those futures companies, etc. We envision conducting baseline research as well as conducting a couple of focus groups or roundtables in the Chimkent region of Kazakhstan, and we will target Uzbekistan's informants and then invite them to Chimkent. Our intention centers on facilitating a joint discussion of Uzbek and Kazakh farmers, whereby they can exchange experiences and viewpoints, especially pursuant to Uzbek's learning market conditions. In turn, the goal of the project would be a productive outcome to discuss an agenda for agro-reforms so that activists and farmers can engage the government competently. We hope to be able to play a role in helping local activists and farmers come up with their own talking points in dialogue with the government of Uzbekistan. Of course, as a person who has worked in rural settings in Uzbekistan to the extent that I have, and who has repeatedly witnessed the disconnection between ordinary people and people in power, I don't go into this proposed project with great expectations. For all we know, the status quo for cotton production and labor organization suits the needs of the current regime just fine. I don't think, for example, that the regime is at all concerned about protests, rebellions, or uprisings. However, various types of international pressure, coupled with a new approach toward creating even more wealth through a more productive and satisfied populace, could cause people in power to begin to rethink cotton farming in terms of self-interest. Above all, the custom or practice, traditions, call it what you will, of seeing common farming people as beasts of burden has got to come to an end. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I want to have about 10-minute commentary. Thank you.
There is this popular saying that, you know, if two Uzbeks meet each other, wherever they might be, they will always find a common connection. And that's exactly what happened. We apparently stayed in the same village. I was there a year earlier. So I read this book with great interest. Actually, when Regine sent it to me, I was telling that when I came from a business trip, I couldn't find it. Then I realized that my wife was reading it. If I may start, you know, my quick comments with a small anecdote. The World Bank wanted an opinion on a particular factory, agricultural factory in Fergana Valley, so they sent me there, and I have invited a former government employee who spent 18 years as a deputy head of an association in accounting to go with me because he was from Fergana Valley. I said, I'll offer you a trip home, you know, and a round trip home, and then you can give me your opinion on what you think about the factory. And I gave him the books, the financial books of the factory. So when he came, he looked around and said, that's exactly how I imagined it. And I was very surprised because, you know, not only people cook books, but it's also that, you know, you cannot really visualize something from two pages of paper. What I want to say is that it's very rare for somebody to have a perspective on the same thing where you can imagine something from a paper and, you know, imagine something from real life. And I think that's what the author has achieved. And, you know, kudos to you because, you know, I can, as a person who knows Uzbekistan from work and from personal experience, I find it incredibly perceptive. And some of the observations are very detailed, actually. What I wanted to offer as my commentary is another perspective, a perspective of a professional agricultural economist, somebody who has worked in Uzbekistan, although I haven't worked in Uzbekistan for, you know, 8 or 9 years now. I have visited Fergana Valley and Namangan quite frequently. I have some personal visit in 86 and 94, and I visited a number of times as a part of my job. I have also studied in agriculture university where I have interacted with my classmates. Most of them were from rural areas. I'm a city boy myself. I'm from Tashkent. My first impression from communicating with my classmates is that every region is very different, and Fergana is very different. Fergana Valley is very different. Namangan is very different from Fergana Valley. So the other perspective, the perspective of an agricultural economist is you know, going from macro to micro is that according to the poverty assessment that the World Bank did in 2001, this was the first independent poverty assessment of Uzbekistan. Namangan, together with Kashkadera, came out as the poorest district, poorest region in the country. And this is surprising because there was a major government assistance program to Namangan, which at that time, at official exchange rate, was about $800 million, which was spent over 2 years for improving condition in Namangan region. So it shows how difficult it is to translate funding into the improved living conditions, because they clearly don't show up in your book, you know. In early 2000s, I found that the regional governor, whom I had the privilege of knowing, was, compared to the other governors that I knew in Uzbekistan, was a bit more progressively minded, which was reflected in better, relatively better climate in bringing in FDI. I think they doubled the FDI investment compared to Andijan and Namangan over a couple of years. Local banks performed better, and the construction industry was more competitive compared, you know, to several other regions in the country. Although many people would know that a microfinance program, a highly promising microfinance program, which was run by Mercy Corp in Fergana Valley, unfortunately did not succeed in because of the overall banking sector regulations constraints. And Nestlé, who had major investment plans in Namangan, actually, after years of trying, they basically given up because they wanted to develop agriculture in Namangan, and they couldn't really do it, you know, within the existing macroeconomic framework, which wasn't there. Going back to agriculture, you know, many of us know that after Soviet Union collapsed, agriculture was in free fall, essentially. A lot of agricultural products have been subsidized, particularly livestock, silk, and cotton, believe it or not. Cotton was incredibly profitable, so collective farm managers would hide losses under other products because it was just incredibly profitable. It was like 50-60% profitability of cotton production. So they, you know, not to embarrass people, they would hide these figures by basically moving profits from cotton to more less profitable parts of the activities. I think what is interesting to note is that a lot of decisions, although many decisions were made from Moscow, and therefore explains a little bit of passive attitude of the local government towards changing things or adapting to things when they were falling apart. There were a couple of experiments which Uzbekistan did in the beginning, I think earlier than other countries in the region, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, which unfortunately failed because timing was not right. For example, the free private farming has been promoted as early as 92, but because of significant deterioration in terms of trade, basically all agricultural activity was fundamentally negative. The cash flows were fundamentally negative. That experiment failed. So about 6,000 farms have been created, and all of them have been in debt for 2 or 3 years. So the government basically has given up on private farming at that time. Although the window of opportunity was there, it just was the bad timing. Similarly, with cotton trade, there was a small window given for private sales of cotton. There were some abuses in the system, but then, you know, people who wanted to maintain the status quo presented this issue as a major failure, so the government backtracked and established a system of absolute control over the cotton trade. Regarding cotton, I brought in some statistics I was sort of preparing for this visit, and you can, for Fergana Valley and for Namangan in particular, and for Uzbekistan in general, cotton is king, but the cotton acreage has been reduced considerably. I have data for 1980s, 90s, and 2000. I don't have 2010 data, but I'm sure, you know, it's been reduced further. In 1980, in Namangan, the cotton acreage was 476,000 hectares. In 1990, it became 390, so it was a reduction of about 20%. And in 2000, it was 243,000 hectares. So It's roughly about 30% of irrigated land is under cotton. On the national level, horticulture production exports, they have boomed. They basically, I think, quadrupled over the last 10 years, and the total revenues from horticulture, fruits and vegetables, are now exceeding that of cotton. So there's been an increased drive. The government has been encouraging farmers to grow more, you know, fruit trees and things like that. But then, again, it's not being done voluntarily, because if farmers had the choice, they would go for something which is cheap, easier to produce, cheaper to produce, because horticulture requires extensive capital investments, and basically many people cannot afford that. I think the basic problems with cotton is that farmers, I mean, you know, you use words like serfs and fiefdoms. I mean, I think, you know, they're basically employees of collective farms. There is no connection between international cotton price and the price that farmer gets for his cotton. All he gets really is the picking fees, which are very low. And the farmers usually, the collective farms, they usually end up being in debt, because the government prices cotton in a way which is lower than international price. But the biggest problem is that even if farmers were to be given full international price, it will still not be a most profitable thing to do, given the yield levels. I mean, our very rough estimate is about 35% of people will continue to grow cotton and others will switch to something else. I would like to end my commentary with some comparative analysis with Shymkent, because we do it, you know, my colleagues do it quite a bit. They actually took government officials of Uzbekistan to the border during the cotton harvesting campaign to show all this illegal movement, not illegal, but basically smuggling of Uzbek cotton to Shymkent. Because if you look at the statistics in border areas between Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan, you will see considerable jump in yields in Kyrgyzstan and in Kazakhstan. And this is not really in yields. This is accounting for the smuggled cotton from Uzbekistan. In 2006, Shymkent region has about 11 cotton ginneries, so they hired, each one of them hired about 150 people, and they gave them, you know, bags of cash to go buy cotton from Uzbekistan at the border. Uzbekistan responded by putting 5,000 policemen on the border. So at 1,500 people with cash and 5,000 people with guns. So, you know, who you do you think will win? Cash wins always. So it was not unusual to see governors or government officials actually encouraging farmers, say, okay, go ahead, you know, sort of for turning linear eyes towards this trade, because this is how people can earn some real cash. But, you know, by saying that, I think that study with Shymkent area would be incredibly interesting. Because, you know, that, you know, regardless of you know, freedom of farming, Shymkent farmers continue to grow cotton. So, you know, maybe you know, the end result is that Uzbek government will start trusting its farmers more, and basically trusting them to make the decisions which are good for them. Probably we all hope that that will happen. I mean, I enjoyed reading this book. I thought it was extremely perceptive, very accurate. Now I realize that, you know, I lived in the same village. I'm going to go back and look at the photographs again, see if I can remember anything, anyone. Is that my 10 minutes?
Sure.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm going to take the liberty of asking the first question, and then we'll open it up to the rest of the audience for your questions and your comments and your insights. My question is actually on this question of pressuring for change. I mean, we've heard different ideas, you know, pressure from the international community, whether it's international human rights organizations or international corporations that buy cotton in their apparel production process. And we've also heard of the potential for change from below, from, let's say, the farmers themselves. Can you talk a little bit more about, for example, with international pressure, whether it's human rights or through the multinationals themselves, how you see that process evolving, who the actors are. Is there any real change that you've seen either on the ground or at the level of the government that would be worth flagging and watching in the future?
Yeah, thanks for the question. To be really honest with you, it was never a realm that I paid like tons of attention to, because I sort of had a cynical attitude about these pushes for change, and then they, you know, they'd be popular for a while when something egregious happened, and then they'd kind of die off. But right. I noticed that, I guess, really over the past 2 or 3 years, in terms of cotton, especially when there were these kind of announced boycotts, like we're going to boycott this cotton, I think to some degree that resonated with the leadership structure. I mean, it's one thing to say, you know, you have kids going into the field, and then the government turning around saying, we don't force these kids into the field. It's the families themselves who are bringing these kids into the field. And so that, you know, that kind of defensive posture lasted only so long. But I think once, and it's mainly the European countries, not the United States, for example, so much that imports Uzbek cotton. I think when it was sort of hard-hitting on the one hand, like, we're not going to buy your cotton. But on the other hand, there was sort of this idea, like, you can do something progressive with cotton. We're not saying, like, we don't want your country to grow cotton, but there are so many problems associated with cotton growing that are beyond just not paying people and being mean to them. It's about the health and the ecology of your country as well. I believe that that's beginning to have some effect. Could I say that I've seen it at the local level? Absolutely not. I mean, I haven't. But then again, you know, some of this stuff is really pretty fresh. Yeah. So, but I think it's when it's progressive and when it's not just beating the government over the head, which has been done for a really long time, and I'm part of that crowd too, I guess. I think you have to move beyond that. And so I'm sure there are a lot of really capable and really intelligent people with positions of power who don't want it to keep continuing like this. And so I think it's got to be like a concerted effort and not just, let's say, Europeans telling the Uzbeks what to do, because that's never going to work. So I don't know if that really answered your question, but sort of groping toward what I think is progressive.
Okay, let's open it up to questions then. Will, and then we'll go here.
Yeah, yeah. Just to follow up on that point that you mentioned.
Thanks so much. You've mentioned these boycotts, which, again, I think if you could just flesh out a little bit more detail. I mean, who's leading the boycotts? How do they find out about it? I mean, if it's European countries, how is the information getting from Uzbekistan to Europe so that it's mobilizing governments or NGOs or somebody to go out of their way to begin a boycott? That sounds like a very progressive but a very intensive project. And I'm very curious how that is evolving. And that goes on to the next question, is really, what are the markets for Uzbek cotton? You mentioned, again, just in passing, that a lot of it seems to be going to the United States. But is it particularly competitive? Is it cash king? And how viable is the cotton trade?
Yeah. I think very little actually goes to the United States, from my understanding. And I think the international trade in cotton toward the West, I mean, the most recent estimates I heard were somewhere between like $350 and $400 million. But mostly Europeans were buying the cotton. What I know about, the little bit I know about where Uzbek cotton goes in terms of the United States, is into your bedding. So it's not like it's used for clothing. It's usually used for things that you would take completely for granted. That's why you wouldn't see things labeled made in Uzbekistan in the U.S. as a cotton product. And I don't really know the extent to which a single European government has basically said, that's it, we're not buying any Uzbek cotton. But I do know that these, like the ILO, International Labor Organization, has been working with members of European parliaments to say, let's ratchet up the pressure on Uzbekistan. Let's not endorse what they do in the cotton fields, because basically they're a unique country. It's not just that there's child labor. Usually when there's child labor in cotton, and there's child labor in cotton in Mali, there's child labor in cotton in Egypt, there's a lot of places. But the difference with Uzbekistan a little bit is that the Uzbek government has kind of forced children into the field. That's the way it's seen in international circles. So I think that's starting to resonate. But I don't have statistics that have really hurt or damaged the Uzbek cotton trade. But maybe.
Yeah. There's an international cotton advisory committee just across the board. Yes, there's an international cotton advisory committee in Washington. They're sort of tracking the sales of Uzbek cotton. I think financially it did not reflect in the price of Uzbek cotton because, first of all, there's been a major reversal of the trade flows. Cotton no longer goes to the West, it basically goes to the Asia. And Uzbekistan has this advantage of being able to sell cotton in larger lots, like 50,000 tons, 100,000 tons, easy. I mean, no other country in the world can do that anymore because farmers are small and, you know, no governments actually are involved in trading of cotton. So there are advantages in countries in Asia, you know, China, Vietnam, and others who are buying this cotton. I think it's more, the Uzbek government is more concerned with an image problem rather than, you know, the financial sort of aspects of it. But, you know, the U.S. And Europe not buying Uzbek cotton is not hurting it financially, so clearly no. That was an assessment of International Cotton Advisory Committee of, you know, 2-3 years ago. So it's more of an image situation rather than financial constraint.
Mm-hmm. So there are basically other buyers outside the West who are willing to buy the cotton. Yes, a question here, and then we'll go to back. Okay, great. Here then, please. Thank you for your observation.
Thank you for your comments. Both of them are really enlightening, and I look forward to reading your book. My name is Matt Fisher-Dale. I coordinate the Cotton Campaign, which is involved in some of the work that has been described to pressure for policy change on behalf of the Uzbek government, and specifically to end forced labor in the cotton sector. And, you know, just a comment about the flow of cotton around the world. I mean, we're really talking about 6 steps of a supply chain before it's getting to something that you or I see in a retail store. So in terms of where the pressure points are, there's quite a few around the world in terms of where Uzbek cotton ends up, although that's certainly true that the initial sales of raw cotton are primarily going to Asia. You know, I think there's a lot of information that is difficult to uncover in Uzbekistan with regards to trade and cotton flows. Increasingly, there's a lot more information being discovered from significant efforts to do so. But I wanted to actually ask a little bit more about Professor Zanka. You mentioned, pushing for progressive change and some of the people in positions of power. And earlier in your comments, you mentioned folks actually within the Uzbek government who may be softliners, as you put it. But I wonder if in your research you started to identify little lights or groups of people coming together and actually seeing ways that it's more in the Uzbek government's interest to change the cotton sector. So that is people that are really seeing economic opportunity in reform. It occurred to me that you were kind of referring to such things, and I wondered if there was more to that.
Thanks a lot for the question. It's a really good one, and the answer is no, because I haven't done serious field work there for about 6 years, and so I think a lot of this is based on, I know that a lot of what I kind of speculate about is really based on things that I read. It's not based on my field work experiences, and I never really had the sense that people in local areas were getting together and saying, hey, we've got a good idea here. Let's talk to these local officials and see, you know, what we can. And I'm not saying that that didn't happen or didn't go on, but I certainly was never really a witness to it. It didn't really flow that way. And I don't even know that it's really flowing that way right now, but I do know that there are plenty of people in power who are much more progressive-minded than you might think. And I have met people like that. But the question always hinges on whether or not those people can make things happen, right? I mean, that's the bottom line. So, you know, Uzbekistan has been in a really horrible way, but that doesn't mean that there aren't people there who can, turn things around or begin to turn things around, and I really think there are. So, yeah.
Nope.
Okay.
Thank you. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Namangan in 98 and 99. I guess I was there when you were there. But I'm an environmentalist, and I traveled from, you know, way in the east, Namangan, Ferghana Valley, all the way up to the Aral Sea in the west. And it's shocking, even then, in the late 90s, to see how much of the water in the sea had shrunk down to a very small lake that had originally been much further out, much bigger. And I was told that one of the reasons is that the two major rivers, Oxus and Zaxartes, or wherever they're called in Uzbek, I forget.
Sir Niamu.
Yeah, thank you. The Sir Niamu. The water from those rivers was absorbed to such a great extent by the cotton crop itself that it required so much water that the trickle flow by the time it reached the Aral Sea was negligible. And now with global warming, and I assume that the rivers originate in the Tian Shan or thereabouts, I'm wondering whether, in fact, the rivers themselves are shrinking and whether the cotton crop will soon become just not a possibility. Can you tell me something about, well, you say you haven't been there since the late 90s, but you must know something about the way that global warming and climate change is affecting agriculture in Central Asia.
I think, Bexod, you should have the first crack at water.
I mean, it's Ferghana Valley is really supplied by Sirdarya River. It's, and Ferghana Valley is like, if you imagine, it's like a bowl. So it benefits from a lot of groundwater, which accumulates under it. So it's relatively a water surplus area. The thing is, Uzbekistan, the irrigated area, it's I think it's more than doubled over 20 or 30 years, and a lot of has been expanded there in areas like Sirdarya and Jizak. This is Sirdarya Basin, and a lot of area has been expanded in places like Bukhara and Kashkadarya, especially pumped irrigation. Those are the ones who, you know, are responsible for the excessive use of water. So Amu Darya and Sir Darya's situation is a little bit different. The climate change, yes, I mean, I think it's a lot of people are modeling the climate change. The thing is that the water is coming from the glaciers in Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan. But the hotter it becomes, the more water it will be. The problem is they will last for less. But cotton is certainly one of the bigger users of water. So is rice and other crops. But the problem is not really, it's not only crop choice, it's also the water management. For effective water management efficiency, need two things happening in parallel. Actually, three things. Two of them, one of them is water use associations, participatory water use, for which you need land reform and other things, and training. And then the reform of the irrigation departments, supply of water, so it should be supplied, you know, in time. And third, you need a lot of investments. So none of those things are happening to the extent required, and these things usually take 20, 30 years to start achieving the results. So, you know, otherwise we'll be just too late. That's the biggest problem. Yeah.
It's going to be tragic.
Yeah.
The only comment I want to add to that is that, you know, Bexod was part of, like, this really amazing study, I think, that was published in 2003 by the World Bank. It was a project undertaken by many different people with expertise in water management. And one of the ironies is, of course, well, it's absolutely true what you say, that, you know, the Aral Sea stopped being fed, and that what led to this unbelievable tragedy. But many areas of Uzbekistan are actually really water-rich. You know, there's lots and lots of water, like, for example, the runoff from the mountains, the glacier, and there's also considerable groundwater resources, even in parts of central Uzbekistan. But the point is, and like what this report shows and many other studies of irrigation have shown, is the incredible waste of water through the canal system. On the one hand, it's a brilliant system of canals, right? I mean, you were there, so you know. But it's the inefficiency and the failure to repair them and, you know, to be able to do all that, reconstruction work that, you know, any state, any local government has got to take stock of, I think, and really work very hard on. And I think that is a huge problem. It's part of the Soviet legacy, yeah. And it wasn't really addressed. It hasn't been addressed in the first couple of decades now, I think. So.
Yeah, we'll go here. Jeff.
Thank you for two very interesting presentations. My name is Jeff Goldstein. I work at the Open Society Foundations. It strikes me that the Uzbek cotton system right now is a huge, not even very hidden tax, not only on the farmers, but also on the people who mobilized basically for no pay to go pick cotton, be they kids or government employees or whatnot, in the favor of the state. So in terms of how you get rid of the system, it seems the pressure obviously needs to be part of the equation, but it also would seem to me that if you're proposing to kill the golden goose, it behooves you to have some ideas about how you replace it. And since, as you pointed out very clearly, the government really doesn't care about how well off the peasants are, the farmers are. They care about how well off they are. So particularly, Bexald, from your point of view, what would be a good replacement in terms of government revenue, foreign hard currency revenue, if they were to replace cotton? And what could the international community, including the IFIs, do in terms of promoting agricultural reform or some kind of substitute? What sort of positive alternative could we offer?
Well, I'll say something that's a little bit, naive, because I'm not an international commodities guy, but it seems to me that maybe part of the emphasis should be on a much more efficient system of cotton production, of high-quality cotton, reducing. And it's absolutely true that there were measures undertaken in 91, 92, let's reduce the acreage sown to cotton. That's part of this legacy that has ruined us, and a lot was taken out of production. But there wasn't a completely different way of managing the system or producing the cotton. There were all kinds of international cotton experts in there in the early 90s, too, including Israelis. I mean, people from all over the world. So it's not as if you don't have Uzbek cotton experts who know an awful lot. But I guess for whatever reason, I would speculate that it's a cash cow. It may, why the system's not broke for me, so why should I do anything to fix it? I think that's been a part of it. I think, this emphasis on agriculture is great, fruits and vegetables, grains. I mean, my one understanding in Uzbekistan, for example, in the livestock sector, is there's meat all over Uzbekistan. There are no meat shortages now. There were meat shortages, but that's become a very profitable sector of the economy. But the thing is, for the country to really develop and grow, agriculture has its limits, I think, in terms of creating national wealth. So I'm not an agricultural expert in terms of, how that is going to make for a strongly developed economy. I think most of us associate strong development with a certain degree of industrialization. Mm. And, I just think of terms like efficiency, diversification, meeting world market demands for high-quality goods. But I can't imagine Uzbekistan totally, not growing cotton. It doesn't make sense to me, because it is one of the greatest places in the world to grow cotton, I would think.
Mm. In terms of compensation, compensating the government, in the countries where there's been a successful change, cotton, rice, and other, like China and Vietnam, what happened is just the sector just collapsed, and then the government just let it go, and then it sort of resurfaced. I mean, what happened in China is that the sector, basically, when the government gave farmers the freedom to grow whatever they wanted, the cotton acreage went like that. But in 2 or 3 years, it went back even higher levels than it was, because farmers realized that if they do higher yields, they can actually earn something. The problem with substitution in agriculture is that I don't know how much it is now, but 10 years ago, Uzbekistan was self-sufficient potatoes, but it was using only 4% of its land to grow. So there's a limit of how much you can expand acreage and other things. Cotton is 35% of the land right now. So if it's self-sufficient in fruits and vegetables, which are perishable, which are hard to export, hard to store, cotton you can store indefinitely. Cotton also gives you other things. I think this is a problem with cotton in Uzbekistan. It's not that it's just cotton per se, but it's, as Mr. Professor Zanka said, is the system works, but it's very inefficient. That's the problem. But you know, you either wait for the sector to collapse or the government basically get tied, you know, other sectors of the economy grow and they just give up on it. I don't see any other solution.
I'm going to collect maybe two or three questions now, and then we can have our panel respond. Yes.
Yes. My name is Simbul Khan, and I'm a Pakistan scholar here at the Woodrow Wilson Center, but I worked extensively. My PhD is on Central Asia, and especially on Uzbekistan, mostly security, but I've engaged with this agricultural sector. I think a couple of questions together. One, just a little bit more of data. What percent of the population is engaged in cotton production? That and another question which is quite similar to what was asked just a little while before. I think most of the problems that we've talked here today are something I have something to do with the privatization of agricultural sector, and there has been hits and misses there, and Uzbekistan has moved back and forth with that. They started with the farms and then they've rescinded, they gave that up. I'd like your comments on how do you rate the success story of any comparative success story in the region. Of course, Kazakhstan I think has had some agricultural land privatization. And what and how that can be maybe marketed to Uzbekistan, because I think there was a drive at a certain point to, you know, go with privatization of agriculture, and then the state kind of backtracked on that. So how, if there can be a long-term movement there where, you know, some of that can be privatized. My other question was to Professor Zanka, the role of agricultural associations. I mean, there are a whole number of agricultural associations in Uzbekistan, and you feel that, you know, they've really not been proved themselves as vehicles of change or, you know, kind of fighting for the farmers' rights. If they're not doing that, then what exactly are they doing that? How do they make themselves instrumental in the whole kind of agricultural sector? Thank you.
So I actually, one of the slides that didn't show up, I had some informal data about population, and I think it's a conservative estimate to say that 50% of the population of Uzbekistan is rural. In the mid-90s when I worked there, people were convinced it was 65%. But, you know, there was Soviet standards about what constitutes a rural region as opposed to an urban, as opposed to semi-urban. So anyway, to cut to the chase, I think it's fair to say that 50% of the population is sort of fully rural. Of that population, people say at any time of the agricultural cycle, probably 25% of that population is engaged directly or indirectly in cotton, the cotton economy. So it's a pretty substantial number of people. Yeah, exactly, right. So, and, you know, there's population estimates that Uzbekistan has 30 million people. I've heard other experts say, no, that's really an inflated figure. It's probably more between 25 and 26 million. So, at any rate, farms and privatization. Why didn't it succeed? Like Beksoud mentioned, there were all these early projects and they were a disaster. Well, I mean, I think part of the reason is that if you don't have any experience at all with knowing how to run a business or run a farm, for that matter, you don't have easy access to credit, microcredit. You don't have easy access to inputs. You don't have training in, you know, land ownership and the idea of making deals, for example, with a futures group about what you're going to produce, what the prices are going to be like. That, to me, just spells disaster. And so I guess, you know, without being an agricultural economics kind of person, really, with a strong background in that, it seems to me that where there's been some modicum of success in Central Asia, like Kazakhstan and maybe more limited Kyrgyzstan, you know, you've had a state that maybe it's a bit authoritarian or not authoritarian, whatever the case may be, but they seem to have had a commitment to those aspects for agricultural life, rural life, that we want our farmers to make their own decisions. We want them to produce. Maybe we have a lot more land. We don't have to worry so much about who's going to buy it and who's going to employ whom. I mean, Uzbekistan, in the most productive agricultural regions, of course, one of the great problems is you have incredible population density, like the Fergana Valley. So it's not easy to just say, oh, you know, everybody buys land now. So that, I think that, I'm groping around here, but I think that's part of it. You asked about agricultural associations and farmers fighting for their rights and trying to represent themselves. I mean, of course those associations exist, but I think in the past 10 years or so, I don't know if Pixar would agree with me, but the example that a lot that we were reading about with a lot of interest was in this region of Jizzakh, which is not too far from Tashkent. And there it seemed that the farming people were very activists. They had had some privatization of plots. And then there was, I think, more a local decision, but I don't really know the internal maneuverings. This governor decided that he was taking back this land. And people went kind of crazy. And so they started to protest. And in hindsight, you might say, well, these guys didn't give it the right approach. But I think, on the other hand, that was, you know, sort of a height of a dictatorial way of looking at the peasant population. And this is the kind of guy, you know, you've heard these stories, who'd go over to individual farmers as the governor and slap them in the face or beat them up or threaten them. And you have exactly that kind of way of dealing with peasant people like their children. Like, if you don't listen to me and do what I say, I can use, like, corporal punishment against you. And so, I mean, I guess the answer to, like, what have the agricultural associations been doing, I think they're toothless. You know, I think they're sort of symbolic. But I think now, you know, why not try again to say, can we develop, you know, a way of making, you know, giving them teeth, but in a very progressive, reasonable way? And of course, as I say, that implies that you have to have some degree of people from those with power who want to make this a better relationship. And then lastly, and I'm sorry, I'm sure Bex has things to say, but just about the child labor, there are laws in Uzbekistan that say you absolutely cannot employ children. Children should not be working in the cotton fields. So that's always been the entire issue for organizations like the ILO, saying, well, there's international agreements. This shouldn't be happening. Why is it happening? And the government saying, like, well, we're not really saying that those kids should be working in the fields. But then you say, well, you closed the schools down. You told all the kids to go into the field. So what's going on here?
I mean, the degree of privatization, you can see the difference between prices for cotton. If the harvesting time comes, you're generally highest in Kazakhstan because they have most efficient credit systems. The input supply is more efficient. It's less so in Kyrgyzstan, although it's also very high. I think Turkmenistan, the government has been increasing prices recently, but I think it's government who procures it anyway. So Uzbekistan would be marginally below Tajikistan. Tajikistan also has problems on its own. There you have private monopoly, private sort of problem. That's. I mean, Afghanistan, they're the highest, but we all know what they're putting inside the bale. So it's not.
There was a question here.
More of a comment that occurred as we were talking. You know, it just is quite a striking figure that a quarter of Uzbekistan's population is forced into labor by the government to harvest cotton.
Well, hold on. I don't know if I mean, even as a harsh critic, I don't know if forced into is totally the right term.
Well,
but, like, no,
just
maybe
to go
no
back
exit?
To the farmer situation, which were described as serfs and fiefs, and is accurate. We're talking about people that don't have any decision-making authority over their land, are handed prices, et cetera. That's a very complex relationship. But we're also talking about the vast majority of not just children, but any employees of the government who understand that they go to participate in the harvest or they risk losing their job. And that's really significant. Yeah. And I just wanted to raise that point that, you know, it is forced labor, but it's forced child labor. It's both things. It's children and adults. Yeah. And I just thought it's important to recognize that because it's even more egregious than child labor, which is clearly a devastating problem for a country around the world. But here it's not only the children, but it's the adult population as well.
On one hand, well, I'm not Bahori Mamba from The Voice of America, I'm sorry. I grew up in one of those collective farms. I come from Bostanluk district of Tashkent region, which borders with Kazakhstan. And it's one of those very few districts in Uzbekistan that does not produce cotton. So I did pick cotton growing up, but in other districts, because we would be sent to the other parts of Uzbekistan. Where I come from produces great food and vegetables. And my mom still farms. She's a veteran kolkhoznitsa. She was a very proud collective farmer. And she would tell you that, well, you know, if she were to compare the period before the independence and now, she would tell you, well, it was much easier to bring up 9 children, educate them, and sort of run a big household as a collective farmer then, but now you can't do that. And many farmers like her complain that they still don't own the land. That seems to be such a fundamental issue for them. And you're right. A lot of them probably would not be able to handle it as a business because they don't have the skills to run it. They don't have the necessary financial knowledge or expertise to be the agrarians, the private agrarians. But the fundamental issue seems to be the lack of freedom. Because the agricultural structure in Uzbekistan now is so complex, I have never met anybody who can actually explain how it is. I mean, I would be really grateful, Big Zot, if you could explain. I mean, you don't have collective farms now. You have agrarian firms, right? So these are people who sign the long-term lease with the government.
Yeah.
And so these people usually are the richer population, people who can actually do that and with incredible contacts with the government so that they can do it. And then they subcontract the land that they lease from the government to smaller farmers. Mm. Would it be accurate to say that the majority of farmers in Uzbekistan are small farmers? These are people who have lands that, let's say, up to 5 hectares. And depending on where they live, they can determine what to produce. Of course, if you live in a cotton district, you have to produce cotton. In other areas, you can produce other things, but at the end of the day, they just have no profit. I mean, we've interviewed so many farmers from various regions, and we constantly talk to them, and they say we work very hard, but at the end of the day, we get maybe 10 to 5% of the profit for us because when the profit comes, they have to share it with the agrarian firm that has the lease with the government, and then they pay taxes. So I can tell you that my mom made about $10,000 of profit last year, and the amount of money that she got maybe under like $500 at the end of the year. And she produces apple and cherries, and a lot of them are bought by the traders who take them to Russia. So, I mean, any thoughts, insights on that? I'm sorry I spoke too long, but...
Is there another question out? Let's maybe stick with this question. We can open it up one more time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when you say two Uzbeks, when they meet, they always find a connection. My grandmother is from Bastanlig, actually. So it's not that. I mean, there's a lot of complications on land reform, on land relations. I mean, the land code of, was it 98? Yeah, 98. It basically prohibits subletting, subleasing, but it happens anyway. So, there are people, of course, who know agriculture situation in Uzbekistan very well. I haven't worked in Uzbekistan 10 years, so my information is very old. But there is a class, I mean, I think there are 200,000 private farmers. This is... But they are not really constituency for reform, as one could imagine. They are more like part of the establishment, like you may call in Pakistan, like the establishment, because they are more better connected people. They're not really, they're part of the system, essentially. A lot of land is, in private farmers, owned by private farmers, but then again, government control on cropping is persuasive and it's very effective, so they're not really free. But a detailed information of, I am not aware of anything very recent, but if I find, I'll happily share.
Yeah, let's get a couple more questions and then we'll let the speakers have a final word. Yeah, Will.
A couple
couple questions based on some of your answers and questions. You talked about the exodus of the rural population. And I was just curious to, I mean, and I know they send remittances back and so forth, but do they come back physically themselves? Are they bringing back different experiences to the village of having lived in the city? Is that part of the change that is coming, that these experiences, that they don't simply always stay away, but they go back either at harvest time or some other time during the year and bring something that's different back to the village? And my second question deals with the project that you're talking about in Kazakhstan. And my question really is, does Kazakhstan want to be the harbinger of change in Uzbekistan? I mean, are there consequences to kind of conducting this sort of economic training and so forth and having it go beyond economics and becoming politicized? And then all of a sudden, from Kazakhstan's perspective, they've created political instability right there on their border. So is there kind of concern in Kazakhstan that they want to try to keep this kind of very strictly economic and that they don't want it to be transformed into something that is more political?
Thanks. I actually also have a follow-up question based on our conversation. I was kind of thinking about this when you asked your question, Jeff, about the different possibilities for, let's say, the government or for people who are reaping the financial benefits of this system, which is, and this comes from my experience in Kyrgyzstan, where I've started some work on the apparel sector, the garment sector, the manufacturing sector that's in and around Bishkek, where very small companies and shops are working to produce clothing and blankets and other textile apparel goods with imported fabrics from China. I'm wondering if there's at all any movement, or if there's a sector in Uzbekistan that is trying to move up the value chain, essentially, and turn the cotton into, let's say, fabrics or inputs for either a textile or an apparel sector. You mentioned in your book that much of the cotton in Soviet times was sent to apparel and textile producing regions outside of Moscow or in what's now Russia, and then the clothing was sent back. Is there any effort on the government's part, either central or local, to initiate the use of that cotton for any of the manufacturing sectors that could be related?
Okay, well, so what experiences do the people who work abroad bring back? If they go away for 6 months, if they go away for 2 years, some, of course, go permanently. My experience, which is kind of limited with people returning, but I've met quite a few and talked to them, is that what they're not doing that a lot of labor migrants do all over the world and have done for decades is they're not coming back to these villages and saying, hey, guys, this is what we've got to do, or I'm going to give the funds necessary for a completely new water filtration system here. Let's repair some roads. Let me take my know-how and let me take my money to the local government and say, oh, how can we improve some infrastructure here in the village? This may be happening in some places in Uzbekistan, but if so, I'm just really not aware of it. And it's one thing that scholars who've been doing this labor migration research, which is really pretty new, obviously, it's about 8 to 10 years old, have remarked upon. That if you, for example, looked at labor migrants to the United States, you know, to the United States from Mexico or really from anywhere, when people go home, they do all kinds of things. They might build big houses. They might buy more cars. But also they might really invest in their villages or towns where they're from. And so far, I don't see that happening, to my knowledge. The other thing you have to understand is that until very recently, and I hope others will agree with me, who know, that labor migrants from Uzbekistan were vilified by the administration as being traitors, as being, you know, anti-patriotic, because there was plenty of work for those people to do in Uzbekistan. So why on earth would they go abroad? So I don't think to this point there's an incredibly sort of healthy ethos around the idea of the labor migrant going and coming back. And a lot – when it concerns the youth, you know, kids who are 18 years old, 24, 25 years old, I mean, they're really just seen as people who can kind of keep their families afloat and not necessarily bring all these fresh ideas. But I have met labor migrants who, you know, have said like, oh, you know, based on my experiences abroad, what I want to have is like my own car service. I want to buy 10 cars, employ a bunch of people and have a business, you know, drive them all over. All kinds of ideas. I just don't think we're seeing a kind of typical labor migrant return process in Uzbekistan that you see in many other, especially capitalist countries around the world. And that probably is going to change, but I'm not sure how soon. Now, you think there's a possibility with the problem in the Kazakhstan research, huh? I never thought of that. No, of course, those were the first questions I started asking the person, you know, as we were proposing this to one another. I was like, oh, my God, this seems like endless headaches. It'll never work. This is crazy. But then we started thinking like, well, you know, for us, nothing ventured. You know, we probably won't end up in the pokey or whatever. But, of course, not to be facetious, I mean, we think long and hard about what possible repercussions could there be for people from Uzbekistan who might, at considerable risk, decide to go to a place like Chimkent to engage in this round table or have these meetings, these face-to-face meetings with other farmers and engage in these brainstorming sessions and whatnot. So, yeah, I think there are serious risks. I mean, I definitely do. And the last thing we are hoping to orchestrate is, you know, more rifts between Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, because there certainly are some. So, yeah.
They actually may work. I mean, when I was working on Tajikistan, you know, we managed to have government get rid of this stupid tax they had on processing cotton internally. We told them, if you continue like this, your cotton gins in Tajikistan are going to start importing cotton from Uzbekistan. So these bloody Uzbeks removed the same day. So that could have an impact.
Regarding the apparel sector, well, I was trying to follow a little bit. So you were saying that in Bishkek, Chinese people are there, and they are trying to help the Kyrgyz.
Sorry, they're local Kyrgyz.
Local Kyrgyz,
but they're importing the
Chinese fabrics.
Chinese fabrics, yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
But they're ethnic Kyrgyz and some Russian ethnic Russians too, but they're people from Kyrgyzstan who are in this sector.
So if I understood you correctly, you're asking about a kind of internal market for Uzbek cotton, like, you know, manufacturing it, marketing
yes.
it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, okay, two things. I mean, to some extent, Uzbekistan has always produced a certain amount of cotton for, you know, cotton clothing, everyday cotton products. In terms of high-quality garments that everyone, like, really looks up to and respects, that's a little bit of a dodgy question. It may be things that people got used to. But I will say that I had a kind of couple of interesting experiences in the 90s, and actually as recently as 2 years ago, the Textile Museum of Washington, as some of you are probably familiar with, a very wonderful place, they run these tours. So I went along as this kind of historical tour guide with the groups. But what I did get to learn, which was really wonderful, was what is happening in Uzbekistan with all these amazing, you know, traditions of silk, mm-hmm. traditions of wool, traditions of cotton, and my God, like, make things that you can not market just for Uzbekistan, whereas people would say, doesn't need to be chisto nacionalny, don't make it just, mm-hmm. you know, ethnic stuff, because we're not even going to consume that. But think about the world market for our products. And, you know, there are businesses and enterprises, but it's very hard to understand, like, is this something that's catching on, or is this for some kind of elite manufacturers with very elite connections to people in power, and then the handfuls of tourists, literally, who come over sort of see this and experience it and say, like, oh, my God, the Uzbeks are capable of doing all this amazing stuff. And then, you know about high-end cotton goods and a certain very powerful daughter of a leader in Uzbekistan who's, mm-hmm. you know, so,
right.
I don't want to go too far with that, but my point is I don't really think that this is an idea that's ramifying very far into Uzbek society there's fantastic craftsmanship and all that, but I don't see like an international market developing from that. It could. And I don't think the internal market is really a way to do much of anything, you know, to sell to one another. And,
yeah, sure, yes.
The Uzbek government has actually talked a lot about wanting to go up the value chain and mm-hmm. doing more processing at home, but mm-hmm. when you look at the statistics, at least the ones I've seen for the last few years, mm-hmm. the percentage of the crop that's exported as raw cotton is not changing.
Mm-hmm.
So the government talks a good game,
yep.
but they haven't really done it. And again, it's a question of who would benefit from it, I guess. On labor migration, I think one thing that was very indicative, I mean, a lot of people were very concerned, not only for Uzbekistan, but the whole region, about what was going to happen when the crisis hit in Russia in 2008, and were masses of people going to come home. And in fact, people were very surprised how few people did, which I think is a sad comment on the state of play at home, that they were willing to stick it out in Russia rather than go home. But the other thing I would say is I think that venture, I guess, at Andijan is a significant disincentive to the kind of knowledge transfer you're talking about, because that was an example of local businessmen who did try and take an initiative, and look what happened then. So I think there's a fairly active disincentive. I think labor migration is great for the government. It gets the most engaged, the most likely to be unhappy people out of your hair, and they send money back. So it's a twofer in that sense.
And you can cast aspersions on them, too.
And it does seem that Uzbek was also a little bit concerned about some of the religious things they're learning.
Absolutely. Well, or I tell people how, you know, you don't have to keep thinking about the Middle East for radicalization. I've known Central Asians who became very radicalized by being in the United States, you know, in terms of their religious beliefs. So it's kind of, you make of that irony what you will.
Most of the World Bank projects that exist in Uzbekistan focus on agriculture, right?
Mm.
I mean, are there any projects that are, let's say, promoting reform or trying to change the fundamentals in place?
There used to be more of those. I mean, now overall portfolio of the World Bank has shrunk. We only have a handful of projects, I think. I mean, I'm not familiar with our Uzbekistan portfolio, but
I know you do a lot in terms of fixing the irrigation system.
Yeah, irrigation is. But I think it's irrigation. They're talking about projects that justify projects on regional grounds, for example, or environmental grounds. There are projects in South Karakal, Pakistan. It allows to capture some of the water and bring it back to the, you know, to the sea. And in Fergana Valley, that we're talking about, again, capturing some of the water which is lost, but at the same time, you know, diverting it back to the river. So, you know.
Do you have any data that shows how much money is invested in trying to develop the agricultural sector?
Oh, it should be on the website, yeah. It should be. It should be all available on the website.
Not necessarily by the World Bank, but within the country.
By international organizations, yeah, I think should. I mean, there are a handful of them left anyway, so it's easier to collect. But
I think it's great irony that the Uzbek government openly says that it's very proud of its farmers. Mm. You know, farmers feed the nation.
Yeah.
You know, we're an agricultural society, mm. so we bow to the farmers. And yet, you know, the government itself does not invest in developing this sector. And I mean, there are obviously a lot of reasons, because the whole system is corrupt, that people actually benefit from how backward the system is, that, you know, you don't need transparency in the sector. And I mean, I'm just wondering, what can the international community do to change that kind of a mindset? You know, just the fundamentals.
I think the international community could do much more maybe 20 years ago. Now with now you know, the dependence on external assistance is much lower, and there are more options to borrow. Before it was not like that, so there are limitations to the pressure.
Even rich Uzbeks are not investing in agriculture.
They could invest much more, yeah, but then this is it's all really, I mean, when you talk to the government, it's really hypothetical. The government has a system which is inefficient, but it's working. And if you're telling them, you know, if you reform, you'll have 20% increased productivity, that sounds like pie in the sky. They will turn to you and say, show me. And if you look at the former Soviet Union, it didn't work, you know, with small exceptions. On the all in all, it didn't work. I mean, Soviet agriculture has collapsed, and it has not recovered, you know, in many countries, most countries. I mean, in Kyrgyzstan, it did recover. But then they will dismiss us, oh, there's a small holders, these are paupers, they're not, you know, they're producing something like 18th century, using 18th century or 19th century methods. I mean, if there is a compelling story like in Kazakhstan, that clearly would have an impact. But then Kazakhstan has not been doing very well also. There's been a major decline in everything. Agriculture is also not... is a slow-growing sector. It doesn't give you 10, 20% increase. It's a 4, 5% sort of growing thing. And then you need to invest, right? I don't have the data about investments. They should be collected, should be, but I don't have the data. Yeah.
Before we thank our speakers, unless there are any questions, I'd like to thank you all for coming. There's a flyer outside that has two more events listed, one in March on post-Soviet civil wars, particularly the case of Tajikistan and Georgia and the politics of rebuilding militia politics after these wars with Jesse Driscoll. And there's one final event in May that we'll be holding on regional implications of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan with a whole set of speakers. So please take one of these on your way out, and we look forward to seeing you at those events. For now, thank you very much to both of you for such an important and informative presentation.